Now, if you do that when I get done, I'll really be happy. There's a town in England that had foresight that no place in the United States had. 50 years ago, they foresaw the environment problems that we're trying to wrestle with today. And they had an all-day town meeting and immediately foresaw that the combustion engine would be the main cause of their pollution difficulties for years to come and instantly banned it. From that day to this, no one in the town has been able to own anything with a combustion engine, nor could any visitor drive through the town with one. No cars, no cycles, no vans, no trucks, nothing. The biggest part of the day was spent trying to decide, once they banned the automobile in all other forms, similar, how they're going to get around. They weighed the pros and cons of all the different means of transportation, and finally, at the end of the day, settled on the means that from then to the day they've used, and that was the donkey. The only means of transportation in the town, and therefore crucial to the economy of the town. And because it's so important, if you go there and you look carefully enough, you'll see that every old man in town has his own ass. Every old lady has her own ass. Young gals have asses, if you look carefully. Young guys have asses. Now, since that's all they got, they're driving their asses really hard. And if you drive your ass hard enough, it breaks down on you. I don't know if you've ever stopped to picture what life would be like without an ass, but it'd be very uncomfortable. So you borrow somebody else's ass to get around. Now, in your whole life, has anyone else's ass ever moved fast enough for you? So you try to prod it in public so it'll go a little faster. People don't like to have their ass kicked by a stranger. This leads to a lot of fights. Important as they are, people are peddling ass in the town all the time. Thought you'd like that one. Gals are the same everywhere, and a good-looking young gal will park her ass where it doesn't belong, and the local cop has to come along and pinch it. You younger people may not know those terms in that one. Once a year, with the ass as important as it is, everybody parades their ass in public, and they have a beauty contest. Now, I've never known if you, I don't know if you've studied asses carefully, but they come in a wide variety and shape. Asses may differ, but politicians don't. And when they pick the best-looking ass, you'll find the local mayor kissing ass for votes. Come Sunday morning, everybody hauls their ass off to church. And a day much like this, in the middle of the Catholic Mass, an earthquake struck the town, and everybody ran out of the church to save their ass, except for the local priest. He had parked his ass on the side of the church, and those windows had been broken by the earthquake, and he hoped just to jump through the windows and land on his ass. What he didn't know is that was where the main crevice of the earthquake was, and he fell into the crevice by mistake, proving that even a priest can't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. I'm Larry Kowalski. I'm an alcoholic. I also happen to be a Catholic priest who can't tell his ass from a hole in the ground. That's how I got here. Before we get serious, first let me qualify. I have not found it necessary or desirable to take a drink or mood-changing chemical today or any today since May the 21st, 1972. I'm going to steal a joke I heard at a conference in Myrtle Beach that's on the same theme of the one I started with. I think it's neat. This very, very, very elderly woman all of a sudden felt very bad. And she goes to see the doctor, and she says, "Doctor, I feel very unusual today. I don't know, something's wrong." And he stops her, and he looks, and he can't believe it. And he gets his little looker, and yep, and he gets tweezers, and he pulls it out, and he says, "Ma'am, do you realize you had a rectal suppository in your ear?" And she says, "Thank God." He said, "No, I said you had a rectal suppository in your ear." She said, "Yeah, I know. That means I know where my hearing aid is." Hope none of you have a head kick today. One last comment before we start getting serious. I understand. I was up at the restaurant right above here. Well, I don't want to give commercials here. A block from the place with the tornado, and we ate with the tornado alert when you all were out in the hall and taken down in the basement. And we ate right through the alert and everything, but I understand they took you all down to where there was a Coors dart throwing contest. That's real poor judgment. Let me tell you, had you all unleashed the Coors, you'd have done more to this place than a tornado would have done. They'd have been welcoming the tornado. It's a real, real pleasure to be in Omaha. The enthusiasm you've shown already tonight, I carry as a memory from when I was here just roughly 3 years ago almost. It's the end of April. It's one of the most enjoyable times I've ever shared anywhere in AA, and it was the enthusiasm of you that made me enjoy so much the sharing. About a year and a half ago, I was driving 70 miles a day, and I would use the trip to meditate one way. And for almost all of October, my meditations were absolutely flat, 90% distraction. And that hadn't been before. I'd had very good meditations. But I persevered because I know that this is a program of action. And if I keep putting in the actions and walk through dry periods, eventually there'll be results. And then all of a sudden, the results started coming. And what I was meditating on is a story from the Bible. And I'm not telling you to take the story in any way, but just as a story. So those of you who are having difficulty with God, just listen to the story. You don't need anything more, I hope, because I'm going to use it as a theme for all of the sharing. It's a story where a group of the Lord's followers are in a boat, and he's not there, and they're trying to go against the wind, and the waves are bad. And he comes toward them, and they don't recognize the power walking toward them, and they're scared of this power at first. And finally, he identifies himself, and he says it is I. And one of his followers, named Peter, says, "If it's really you, tell me to come to you across the water." And Peter starts walking across the water, and he takes his eyes off the solution, and he puts it on the problem. And he looks at the size of the waves, and he starts getting scared, and he starts sinking. And he cries, "Lord, I'm sinking." And the Lord reaches out and saves him and says, "Oh, pay you of little faith." That meditation started having a little bit of real effect for me. But it became far more important when it occurred to me that this was now the month of November. And it was 12 years prior to this, in the month of November, that I began bottoming out in a very deep way and cried out for help. Wrote the Catholic Church, the officials, and said, "I need a psychiatrist. I'm falling apart." And I did start seeing a psychiatrist. And of course, I got worse until I found the program of Alcoholics Anonymous about 7 or 8 months after that, in May of 72. But I could look at where I was 12 years before, drowning in alcohol and drowning in emotional problems. And a year and a half ago in November, with all the problems that I had, I was sober. And I had had some serenity, and at times I've had very deep serenity. And I know that is as impossible for me as it was for Peter to walk across the water. And that meditation started having an immediate effect for me. But then I took it a little bit further. And I was staying at my sponsor's home, and my sponsor had a swimming pool. I was staying there 2 nights a week. And I started thinking about actually standing on the water of a swimming pool. And the meditation then started getting super rich for me, because that was just so impossible. And what I did as I continued to meditate was I applied this over a course of time to almost all the 12 steps. And each of the steps had a richness when I would start off looking at standing on water and how impossible that was. And I'm going to use this as I share as we go through the steps. So you'll understand, this first session will be on the first step. And then we're going to do the second and third, the next session, then the fourth and fifth, then the sixth and seventh. Not together, each step receiving its own time alone. Then the 8th and 9th, the 10th and the 11th, have one session on the traditions applied to our relationships now in all probability. And then the last session will be on the 12th step, bringing together the themes. I'm going to share on the first step my inability to manage my own life. Basically, my life is a life of hurt. Now, before I start, I want to tell you that what I've experienced, not all alcoholics have experienced. And I want you to know that, because I hear a lot of speakers who go from their own life who will say, all people do this. I've been blessed as a clergyman in the program to hear, I guess, 600 to 800 fifth steps. And off that and my sponsoring and my listening, I can tell you the only single thing that all alcoholics did was drink something with alcohol. We are not all liars, despite what most people say, nor are we all thieves. Now, I stole every cent that was in the forefront of the first church I was in. I'm a liar, so when I say this, I'm not trying to escape the terms for me. But I think this is very important, that what I'm going to do with you is share my experience and how the program works for me. Not all people with any disease have exactly the same symptoms, nor when people are treated for the same disease with the same medicine, do they have the same experiences. If you don't experience what I experience, that doesn't mean you're not an alcoholic. And if your experience of a step is different from mine, that doesn't mean you did it wrong or I did it wrong. I hope, as you listen to the steps, and I've put a lot of thought into this and into pulling together my own experience, I hope you're going to disagree or not have seen things the way I'm going to share, because that'll help you think more. And sometimes in AA, you hear people say, take the slogan, keep it simple. And I feel misuse that to infer, don't think. Bill Wilson certainly thought very, very deeply in the big book, in the 12 and 12, and in everything he did. And I think I do have a power greater than myself that I choose to call God. If God gave me a mind, and I don't think with it, I think I insult it. I think it's very helpful to use what I have on the program that I've been given, aware of the dangers and the limitations of my mind, and aware then of the limitations of my own experience. If you're sitting there and I tell you something I've experienced and you haven't, that doesn't mean anything about you not being an alcoholic. And this is why it's important for us not to say all alcoholics. Because if you're going to tell me that all alcoholics like beer, then alcohol being cunning, baffling, and powerful, and my almost never liking the taste of anything with alcohol and never liking beer because I'd have to drink too much to get what I need at that effect, I'm going to say, well, I'm not an alcoholic, and I'm going to go out and drink. And that's the danger of my going beyond my experience. So what I just want to do is share with you my own experience. And I want to begin by telling you the levels on which I hurt. I hurt physically. I had an older brother who had a streak of cruelty in him. And as a child, my ears stuck out a lot. And he called me Big Ears, and he called me Dumbo. And my mother would use these terms, and they would use them to scar me and to hurt when she really got angry. And I began growing up feeling that my ears went from wall to wall. And when I came into this program, I couldn't mention my ears. I was a hippie priest when I was drinking and using. I did some street drugs. And I loved the hippie movement because I could wear long hair over my ears. And I learned something very important that a lot of sponsors, a lot of us could really profit from. I don't live first in the world of reality. I could look in the mirror, and I block out my face from the mirror. I don't see anything there when I feel that I'm ugly. I could look in the mirror, though, and force myself to see my ears now don't seem to stick out a lot. But I don't live with that. I live with the world of my feelings. And that's very important to know. You don't live first in the real world. You live in the world of your feelings. And if you're beautiful and feel ugly, you start living in a world in which you're hurting from feeling ugly. And when you feel ugly the way I did, there's no escape from that. There's no out of that. It was like I'm on an island by myself, and the world's out there, and I compare my feelings of ugliness with the way you look. And I'll always look at what you have that I don't. Your dimples, if you have dimples, and I'll envy that. Your red hair, the fact you got wavy hair, your blonde hair, your height, your shortness, your thinness, your athletic ability. And you've got it, and I'm ugly, and I can't escape my ugliness. Physically, I hurt because, well, I had all kinds of physical hang-ups. My mother was just such a prude. No form of nudity, even semi-nudity, was allowed in the family, and I still got all sorts of hang-ups on this and hang-ups on toilet training. And there's a lot of physical pain and hurt in my own life. I hurt emotionally. The Al-Anons can identify with this, and some alcoholics. I belong, many Al-Anons, of course, because nothing universal, I'm sure, can be said of them either. I belong to that group of people who feel guilt for being. You bumped me, and this is the best example I can say for it, and I'm going to apologize. You spill coffee on me, and I'm going to say I'm sorry. I've got to justify where I am and what I'm doing at any given moment. And if you feel guilt like this, you can't get out of that. There's no escape from that hurt. There's no easy antidote that you take to all of a sudden feel like you have a right to exist. I felt depression. Depression just as a general stage. I couldn't voice my anger. I felt the anger, but I couldn't express it, so the anger turned inward. And I'd have those huge, heavy fogs of depression. When you know, you just got to call somebody, and it's like there's 10 ton of weight on your little finger, and it's just too much to make a phone call. And I lived with that. I lived with the states of anxiety, with tension headaches all the time, the stomach up tight, psychosomatic diarrhea from nerves and from pain. I hurt emotionally. I hurt intellectually. At the age of 14, I was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I really never got better from then on, unless I was drugged, which took away some of the pain. At the age of 16, I reached the conclusion that I held 2 years into my sobriety. Incidentally, I hadn't started drinking yet, or drugging. And that conclusion was that I would end my life permanently committed to a mental hospital. Because of the things I did that normal people don't do, the feelings I had and the actions I performed, not wanting to perform them. And that continued, as I shared, through my drinking, it continued into my sobriety. I was different from you mentally, and I hurt very badly mentally. I was just other. And I hurt spiritually. This really isn't the God of the Catholic Church, but it's the God that I knew. It was a God who would put me in hell forever, would be happy to see me hurt forever for eating 2.5 ounces of bacon on Friday. A God who would put me in hell for doing anything, put anybody in hell for doing anything sexual that wasn't regular intercourse between husband and wife with the intention of having children. And before they gave me that rule, I used to sit in church during Mass and during the dull, boring sermons. I used to fantasize sex. I was done before they ever told me it was bad. You know, it was all over. And there's no escape from a God like that. If you're damned and you're looking at a world where people don't seem to be walking around with these guilt, it just doesn't work. And I hurt socially. I'd never fit. I never fit in my own family. I'm a middle child. Even though I was my mother's favorite, I didn't fit. My parents had a room, my sister had a room, and my brother and I shared a room. He's 3 years older, and that meant that I slept and changed in that room. I never had a room in my own home, and I didn't realize the effect that had on me till I was 9 years sober. I was a nomad. I went from room to room, studying in one room, trying to recreate in another, but I didn't have a place of my own. And so what I've got today is sacred. You walk into my home and walk over and turn the television set on, and you just made my inventory, my resentment list. If I say you can make yourself at home, you can do whatever you want. But anybody who takes liberties with anything that's mine, I remember that because I've never had anything, no place, nothing that was mine until I started getting things on my own. There was nobody my age in the neighborhood, and so I had to go running off with my brother. And when he was 7, I was 4. And you can't do things when you're 4 the way all the 7-year-olds are doing. When he was 10, I was 7, and you still fail. And that was reinforced when I went to school. I graduated from high school at 16 and college at 20, and I never skipped a grade. But I wasn't as old as everybody else, and again, I was failing. And so I just grew up thinking I couldn't do anything athletic, and the only thing I would ever dare do was swim, because I thought I could do that with a lot of pace. I wouldn't even bowl, because if I bowled at 299, that would crush me, because I felt that every one of you would be watching that last ball miss the last pin and laughing at me. Because that's all my memory was, failing. 43 years old, I put skis on and proved to myself I couldn't ski the first year. I've been skiing for 4 years now, and I have an excellent intermediate skiing style. It's one of the neatest things in the world because I can do things. I can put the effort in, and I can master a lot of stuff. This is snow ski. I can't stay out of the water on water skis yet. I'm going to try some windsurfing this summer. The program is enabling me to try to learn to live and enjoy life and see what happens off that. I went to school in a Polish ghetto, and I didn't live in the ghetto. So I didn't fit in the friendships in the school. And then when I went to public high school, I went into a totally different school system, and they had all their friendships again, and I've just always been on the outside of life. I'm here and life is there, and I'm hurting and I'm all alone, and I didn't know what to do. And I've tried a variety of different ways to bridge from my world to yours. I tried money. That's why I sold everything in the poor fund. Because money is the power to dream dreams, to influence you, to buy your friendship, to buy things. The only trouble with power like this is it gets old and it has to be used, and I still need one that would stop distracting me. I'm a compulsive buyer. I used things to distract me, because when I got something new, the newness of the thing distracted me from the emptiness of being me. The way I first saw this was I had stopped wearing a wristwatch for about a year and a half. I had four of them at the time, I think, at least. And I enjoyed not having a wristwatch, and I walked into a discount store, walked up to the jewelry counter, and caught myself getting ready to buy a Timex, a watch that I didn't want and didn't need. And I said, you've got a problem. Now, I could hold off buying record albums. I won't buy an album for 6 months, and I went into a store in Dallas and bought 40 albums just on a blink. I'm a compulsive buyer because the newness of the thing distracted me. I was very involved in the anti-war movement, because I try to use activities to distract me from me. And if I were running long enough and fast enough, I felt that it would be okay in here. But unfortunately, all the time, I was carrying along the person that I couldn't be, me, that I didn't like me. And I had it stopped. I tried friendship, because people would distract me from my own pain. I liked their personality. But when they started getting close, they really threatened me, because they would see this garbage in here that I hated at that point. And then I'd start getting desperate as the friendships got deep. And they didn't really help me at all. I tried isolation, and that was even worse, because I took into the room the person I couldn't stand. And if you've been there, you'll understand this. I'd have the television set on and be watching it and not watching it, and a book in my hand and be reading it and not reading it, because I just couldn't be alone in a room by myself, even drinking and drugging. I tried psychiatry, the only thing I really worshipped. And I got the best shrink I've ever heard of in the program, and I got worse, and I needed that. Because if I could have blamed my shrink, I'd be out there dying from drinking and using. My drug of choice is alcohol, lest there be any doubt about it. I use the street drugs and the tranquilizers as backup. My shrink had to fail me. I went to him, and I kept getting worse. I tried popularity in the parish, building up my fan club. But the only person I really listened to was me. And if you all were clapping and I was booing, it didn't work at all. And if one of you frowned, I zeroed right in on it, and that destroyed me, because I was made for those negative feelings. I tried an occupation. I grew up in a Polish ghetto, and I know today my reasons for becoming a priest, not God's, for I was frustrated and became a priest and thought I'd be happy, and I had to become ordained to learn if you're frustrated and you become a priest, you become a frustrated priest. And it was at that point that the alcoholism exploded. I tried dreams. God, I lived in dreams. I spent hours in dreams, even in the first 2 years of my sobriety, until it occurred to me that the dreams were really a put-down, because in my daydreams, I would be a perfect everything. Perfect athlete, perfect scholar, perfect businessman, perfect socializer. And my mind knew that this real person wasn't anything like the dream person. And the dream person was a constant criticism of what I really was. And I can't afford that luxury anymore, so I had to come up with alternatives to daydreaming. And I've come up with a real good one. I write novels, compose novels instead, in which I'm not one of the characters. And whoever I'm really mad at happens to be murdered. I'll just give you one. I can be pretty clever. I've had a lot of trouble with bishops. So about like 4 years ago in my sobriety, there was this elderly bishop with a very bad heart whose priest took his heart medicine and substituted Anabuse for it right before a banquet when there was going to be some toasts with wine. And I just thought that was real good. Anyhow, those things didn't work. And then I found my answer. And this is real important. A lot of people forget this. I found alcohol. People forget that alcohol is the answer to alcoholism. It is not the problem. It's the solution. At least it seems to be the solution. When I drank, I didn't feel ugly. Now, my feelings of ugliness were so ingrained, I didn't feel good-looking the way some people did. But I felt like there was a nice electric light inside me that you would want. I didn't feel guilt-filled. I felt kind of romantic. I never felt sexy. Never felt the stud. That's one of the things I liked about snow skiing. You get to put on these heavy boots, and even the women look like they're doing a stud walk across the floor. And I really felt, finally, I've made it into John Wayne's world. Then I went out and I bought some new boots, and they were so light I could walk, and I figured, well, there goes my stud image. But anyway, I felt romantic, and I felt you would want me. I didn't feel crazy. I felt brilliant. I felt like I had the answers to everybody's problems. Now, alcohol drugged me in those areas, but it really worked in the social area. It really did help me mix with you. It changed my perception of me and my perception of you. And only in the last month have I seen that. I didn't feel you were out there not wanting me. I felt you wanted me to be part of you. And alcohol worked. And life wasn't a pain when I had alcohol and drugs in my system. Sure, there were bad side effects. I was alcoholic from the first drink. I didn't like the taste of alcohol. I didn't get drunk all the time. I would have told you a year ago, I told you if I said anything about it when I was in Omaha last time, that I never took a morning drink. I had learned, and the person who helped me find this is present with us today, through a friend of mine who had a professional in the family, what pills to take at night and in the morning that did for me what alcohol did for other people. I never, 10 years sober, 11 years sober, considered about a whole big iced tea glass filled with wine at morning mass, taking a morning drink. 11 years sober, I didn't make the connection. Now, I didn't have the morning service that often, but when I did, you bet I had a lot of wine for it. I have a grape juice permission now to answer the question that a lot of you probably have in the back of your mind, so. Alcohol did all those things. Incidentally, I want to show you something. The same disease can be handled through different treatments, and the different treatments will act in different ways. I want to show you how alcoholism, drug addiction, and Al-Anonism handled my same problem in my life. Alcohol enabled me to bridge myself to your world, and I felt part of it. Drugs didn't do that. The drugs that I did, the street drugs and the doctor-prescribed drugs, I would do them with other people. But I would be on my own little island, and I felt good being all alone. It was just okay to just be here. It didn't make me social. In Al-Anonism, what I want is I want to get somebody who's dependent on me and bring them here on my island of hurt with me so I'm not alone. Alone in my loneliness, to use a phrase that Ramona, also from Oklahoma, used. I won't be alone in my loneliness. Somebody else will be here with me. And if somebody's going to be here with me and I'm sick, they've got to be sicker than me and dependent on me, and I can feel a victim and blame my pain on them. And that's three different ways I use to handle the same problem. Now, the alcohol has some bad side effects. The blackouts, the shakes, the disrupting people's party. But you know, almost any medication has bad side effects. You know, I've got dry skin at times, and I just use Neutrogena to take something very simple for it. But after I put it on, I've got greasy hands. I don't mind the greasy hands because eventually my skin itself isn't as dry. People will take a lot of unpleasant side effects from chemotherapy, weight putting on sometimes, loss of hair, because what they're getting in the overall treatment is okay. And as long as alcohol took care of that hurt, as long as alcohol handled the alcoholism, I could take the side effects. But about the time I lost control of alcohol, alcohol lost control of me. And I wasn't feeling good when I drank. I started feeling ugly. I started feeling guilty. I started feeling crazy. And I started feeling a part of it. And that's when alcohol fell apart. When I was drunk, I would dump things on people, blacked out. I would tell them things that I had difficulty saying in my fourth step, writing in my fourth and sharing in my fifth. And I tell it to my enemies. People I didn't like at all would tell me the next morning, and God, I couldn't live with that kind of stuff coming back at me. But it showed me I hated myself when I was drunk. I'd get drunk and alcohol wasn't working. I wasn't feeling good either. And I started pulling away. Originally, I drank in public. I started drinking at home. I started drinking at home alone in my room. I started drinking at home alone in my room with the door closed and the shades down. I had a friend who took it several steps further. She then went in under her bed, and she ended up drinking in the closet with the door closed and the light out in the fetal position. And I was heading there because I was pulling back in, and alcohol had stopped working. That's real important for me to remember. People forget that alcohol is the solution to alcoholism. Alcoholics also forget that when many of us come into the program, we came here because alcohol and or drugs stopped working. And they don't start working again. Or for a brief period, they might. But they'll never be the answer to my problem again. And so I don't have a solution. I hear people say at AA, and I hope you don't hear this said here, that if the program didn't make them feel good, they'd go back to drinking. They forgot they came because alcohol stopped working. And no matter how bad I get, there's one thing I haven't forgot in 13 years almost, and that is no matter how bad I am, alcohol will make me feel worse right now. It won't help anymore. It's just a negative. It's going to make me feel more hurt, more pain. And so I reached step one. I was powerless over my alcohol. I lost control. I certainly am powerless over my life. I could do nothing trying my best to handle my hurt. There are several things I will hope that you'll get from to do with you. The things on step one, I would like you to remember three absolutes. It is absolutely essential, most of you know that. The next two are equally important, and most people don't. It is absolutely useless and absolutely dangerous. Absolutely essential, absolutely useless, and absolutely dangerous. Hope I got your attention. Now, I mean that incidentally, too. I'm going to share that. Absolutely essential. The only step we take 100%. I misunderstood that for about 5 years to be you take it once. Now, that obviously isn't so because I know people who took the first step who went back out and drank and used again. What it means is I've got to say I'm powerless over all alcohol. There's a lot of little exceptions on that. They brought the desserts over. You've got to be very careful. I have to be of desserts in restaurants. And the first question I had is there alcohol in any of those desserts? I won't even take it when it's cooked because I don't want my taste buds ringing bells. I'm taking the softer road. I don't want to risk what I've got. But I don't dare take it on desserts because often there it isn't burned out. And all of their desserts had alcohol but one in the ice cream. So I had the ice cream. That's the safer way. But you know, right after I came into the program, I thought I was fanatic. About a year sober, I suddenly noticed there's a lot of alcohol in mouthwashes, and I stopped using mouthwash. And 10 years sober, I was sitting at an AA meeting, and the guy next to me just told me he lost 4 years of sobriety on mouthwash. And then he said this. So he said, now I only use Listerine because I don't like the taste. He's telling this to somebody who never liked the taste of alcohol till the very end. 2 weeks after that, a very close friend of mine lost 14 years of sobriety getting drunk on Listerine. And he began just with regular mouthwash. I'd rather my mouth odor offend you. I don't want to wake up in a gutter, you know, with the cleanest breath in town. I'll just take the safer way. I'm powerless over it in cough medicine. In all medication, if it's a liquid medication, I pick it up and read it. Because the chances are, 9 out of 10, there's alcohol in it. I get mouth cankers, the oral herpes. I get mouth cankers, and almost all the medication for it has alcohol. And I hate those damn things. You know, they'll be in an area where they're always a pain, as I say, pain in the butt, no, wrong cheek. Pain in the top. But I just suffer through it. I'm going to go the safer way because I am powerless over any and all alcohol. And there's just, you know, I can't afford to risk it. I feel powerless over all drugs, all mood-changing drugs. In AA, I've heard some things that I don't really agree with, and one that is dangerous. You get the impression that we're powerless when we take the first drink. When I start drinking, I lose control. And I've heard that a lot. And you know, the assumption then is I have power over whether I take the first drink or not. And there's a reflection of this. Real often, people will talk about slips and whether they think there's such a thing as slips or not. And a lot of very good speakers say they don't believe in slips at all. And I think what they're doing is they're going from their own experience where they have planned a drunk. If I'm powerless, I slip. You know, when I fall on ice, I don't fall because I have power. I fall on ice because at that moment I have a slip. I have lost power over whether I'm going to walk or not. And I've seen the same with alcohol. And unless I forget in a few moments, I'm going to give you some dramatic instances of people who have discovered themselves with the compulsion coming back in, the compulsion for the first drink. And I think that is very, very important. You know, knowledge of any disease is useless over that disease. If I know what causes cancer, that's not going to keep me from getting cancer. If I know what brings on a heart attack, that's not going to keep me from having a heart attack. If I know what brings on my alcoholism, that's not going to stop me from taking the first drink. And willpower is useless with diseases. I've never met anybody who wants, well, most of the time, most of the people don't want cancer. They don't want to die of cancer. But their willpower cannot stop the disease. Knowledge of the danger of alcohol doesn't stop alcoholics from drinking. And the desire not to suffer, the desire not to hurt, the recognition of how bad the drunk was won't keep me or anyone else from getting drunk. I had a good friend who on her last drunk needed 11 shock treatments. And she was born in Germany. She lost the ability to talk English for a while. And she knew what a drink would do to her. And she found herself a year later drinking. She came to AA 3 days later and screamed how she couldn't afford to drink and didn't want to. She was drunk the next day. That's important to know. The big book puts it in italics. At certain times, we have no mental defense against the first drink. So I'm powerless when I start drinking, but I'm powerless over whether I'm going to drink or not. And that's what we don't hear enough of often in our program. Therefore, the book says, our mental problem is more important than the physical one, because the mental problem causes me to drink, and then the physical problem brings all the pain into my life when I start drinking. I have no say over whether I'm going to drink again. I am going to drink again. That's what the first step means. I have no power over alcohol. I can't manage my life. That's very important. So it's absolutely essential that I see this, or I won't work the rest of the program. Let me tell you why I say it's absolutely useless. And this is important because it's not pointed out. If I go to a doctor and he diagnoses me as, well, I'll give you the one I've got. I went to a doctor and discovered I had glaucoma. Those of you who are drug addicts, I was in the program 8 years when they told me I had glaucoma. Now, you know what glaucoma is? If you don't know, it's one of the two illnesses when you get government-grown grade A pox. You know, it's just so, he's got a sick sense of humor. That's when he makes it available. I put some damn drops in my eyes twice a day. I wouldn't have said, okay, you know, just now you told me what I got no problem, and I go home and it's all cured because I know what I got. If a doctor says you got appendicitis, you don't go home and say, well, I go know what I got, it's all cured. Knowledge of a disease is not the treatment at all. It's the door to treatment. Until I know what I've got, I'm going to be treating the wrong thing. I'll treat the symptoms, not the cause. I'll be treating the headache or the side ache rather than having the appendix removed, and you can die from that, from band-aid therapy, from taking aspirins while the disease gets worse and the real cause is growing. But when you diagnose my disease, be it cancer, heart problems, TB, or alcoholism or drug addiction, that is in no way a treatment of it at all. And that's where the first step is useless. It does nothing to treat the disease. Not at all. Let me give you some startling examples. I sponsor, I'll share this up early and maybe get to it in one of the later talks, why circumstances. I sponsor some women. I would not normally allow them to cross-sex sponsor. I've done it under very strange circumstances, very experimental, and usually at a distance over the phone, and it's worked well and there hasn't been any problems. And should there ever be, should ever go from the 12th to the 13th step, any desires for it, I would hope at that point either I or they would immediately end the sponsorship. But there hasn't even been any kind of urges on that. They haven't been sick enough. All my life, only the real sick women fall in love with me. As long as I keep them healthy, they'll be safe. Or, you know, I guide them to the program to keep them healthy. But I've got this gal over 5 years sober. I will change names and circumstances so you'll never be able to know, even if you're in these towns. She's not in my area at all. Over 5 years sober, a drug addict. Very good. She works a regular program. She makes 4 meetings a week, does a daily written step and a daily meditation, helped start a noon NA meeting, was driving to it. The day before she was in church, there was a sermon on prayer. She sat there wondering, what do I need? There isn't a single thing right now I need that I'm not getting that I want to pray for. So the next day, after such total bliss, there's nothing she needs. She starts driving to sort of a 7-Eleven store. It was too busy, so she drove to a truck stop and scored some speed. Doing everything, no thought of drugs, scored some speed. She didn't take it for reasons because I feel she was doing everything she should. A friend of mine, 90 days sober, went to go fishing. Gets back in his car at the end of fishing. Made 90 meetings, 90 days. Decides to get drunk. Not to have a drink. Decides to get drunk. He's 70 miles from where he lives. He says, this is too far. Pulls into a bar. I'm sure to get a DUI before I go home. I'll go up a little further. About every 10, 15 miles, would pull into a bar, work the same thing. Caught himself on the outskirts of his town. He says, this is stupid. I'm going to be home before I get drunk. I've got to pick a bar. Debated between the two bars he'd get drunk at. Looked up and he was in his own driveway. The compulsion set in and a power other than him kept him as well as the gal sober. 7 years sober, I got mad at the bishop and decided to get drunk. And you could have told me everything that had ever happened in AA and I'd have told you to go to hell. That wasn't important. The only thing that kept me sober was the one thought that would work. And I think God put it in my mind when the compulsion hit. And that was that if I got drunk, the bishop would be convinced I was the dumb SOB he thought I was. And I was going to stay sober to spite it. But those are instances when the compulsion has just absolutely come in. Knowing what I've got doesn't keep me from having it. Now listen to the next thing when I said it is absolutely dangerous. Because I say this and people often laugh, but I'm serious. Alcoholics Anonymous is sometimes dangerous to continuous sobriety. Because it's very, very simple to begin to think that with 1 year or 5 years or 10 years, I now know how dangerous alcohol is, and I'm not going to drink, and I can cut off on my meeting. Alcoholics Anonymous can enable me to become complacent regarding alcohol. Why else would people cut back on their meetings and stop going to AA? From my own experience. You know, why would they go from 90 meetings in 90 days to one meeting every 3 weeks? It's because they've heard so much and they've seen so much that they really feel they know how bad alcohol is, and somehow that's a buffer between them and drinking. I've got to tell you that with everything I've got, I believe I am as powerless right now as I was 13 years ago today when I was getting drunk. There's no power in me at all against alcohol. Let me give you an example of when the dangerous thing happened in my life. I was teaching at a Catholic high school from which I got fired. Nuns ran the place. Two things I've got to say. It was right when I was in Omaha, I think I was still there. First, I wish I'd gone down and filed for unemployment. And they would have said, what do you do? And I would have said, I preach. I'd love to have seen the person's face when I said that. And the second thing I've got to tell you is I want you to know that I have forgiven those bitches for firing me. Sounds like some of you have been taught by nuns also. It took me 2 years to get over it. That's a real traumatic thing. First time fired in my life. But at the time I was teaching in the high school, I was getting up at 5 and going till midnight almost every day with less than 30 minutes a day to myself, and I had no time to meditate. I was sponsoring, hearing fifth steps, chaplaining the nuns, teaching full-time in the high school, going to AA meetings. I didn't have any time to meditate. And here's something crucial to know. If I needed renal dialysis, I needed my kidneys drained, and I had the best reason in the world for missing my treatment, my system is still going to be just as poisoned as if I had no reason at all. And when I have the best reason in the world for missing my program and I don't get the treatment I need as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, my emotional system gets just as poisoned. In 1 month, I had two friends who missed AA because they were nursing an alcoholic spouse who was dying of cancer. And the spouse died, and in 1 month, both of the living members of AA lost their sobriety. Their reasons for missing meetings were excellent, and they were just as emotionally poisoned as they could be. I started noticing at this period when I was so busy not meditating that all of a sudden I got to meetings at 8, left at 9, picked apart everybody, critical. Any calls from people I sponsored irked me. They invaded my privacy. I had no understanding and identification with anybody who did a fifth step. And what occurred to me after months of this, I finally saw it. I was going to bed saying, of course I'm sober, rather than my God, I'm sober. And I'm going to let you know in a moment by my understanding whether Alcoholics Anonymous right now, up till today, up to this time in your day-to-day, has been dangerous for your sobriety. Have you been going through today surprised you're sober? You know, if you're just saying, well, of course I'm sober, and you're assuming somehow, if you're like me, that you have power over your sobriety. Well, if I'm not shocked, then somehow I'm not really working the first step, because I don't belong sober. I don't belong sober any more than I belong standing on top of water. And the fact that I'm standing on top of that damn swimming pool for 13 years shocked me any more than it would the first second I was up above that water. Am I grateful? Am I shocked right at this moment? That tells me my attitude toward the first step. That's why, as I shared with you, why I feel people quit AA. Somehow they feel their knowledge is what they need. Let me real briefly talk about what it means to me to be unmanageable. So the first step, absolutely essential, or I won't work the rest of the program. I've got to know how dangerous I am. I'm drowning. Absolutely useless. Taking it doesn't cure my disease, touch my disease at all. Absolutely dangerous. Because the more I take it, the easier it is for me to become complacent. I was just listening to a Clancy talk when he talked about how much that word was heard, complacency, in the early days of AA, and isn't anymore. Unmanageable for me is very simple. It means trying my best. I can't put in life what I need to just live drug-free. And I did. I tried my best. I had 12 years of college, nearly all straight A, a respected profession. Put myself into it very much, and I needed to drink. I drink because I can't just walk through life. It's real easy for me to see. I hear people ask, why do they drink? People will, in AA will go out and they have a slip and they come back and they say, I know why I got drunk. And I shudder when they say that. There's only one good answer for that. Why does an alcoholic drink? The answer is because they're an alcoholic and it's the nature of an alcoholic to drink. Why did a person go out and have a drink? Not because of this or that or anything, but because they're an alcoholic. And the normal state for an alcoholic is to be drowning in alcohol. It is not normal for me to be above the water in any form at all. I graduated from Penn State. This is the truth. I drank when Penn State was winning on television to celebrate. I drank when Penn State was losing to mourn. And I drank when Penn State wasn't playing because I was bored. Those were my excuses. I drink because I'm an alcoholic. Got about 3 more minutes maybe if you can bear with me, and I'll wrap this first session up. We're dealing with the principle. This isn't noticed very often in Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12th step does not say we try to practice these steps in all of our affairs. Incidentally, as a priest, I'm not supposed to have affairs, so I don't know what I'll be practicing things in. It says we practice these principles. And I've only heard one person in AA ever discuss the principles of the steps. You know, if I'm driving on an expressway in a traffic jam and all of a sudden I have an anxiety attack, I can't stop my car in the middle of a lane and work the 12 steps. Write out a quick fourth step, do a fifth, you know, call the neighbor, the next car over, do a fifth step, make my list of people I've just injured and start running back to all the dents and making my amends. I can't do that. But there are principles of each of the steps that I can bring anywhere at any time that can help me make my life better. The steps bring certain effects. And the first time and any other time I work them, they deepen these effects. But there are other ways I can capture these same principles in my life. And what I will hope is, please, if you want to make this weekend rich, before a talk, take a moment and ask yourself, what do you think the principle of the second step is? What do you think the principle of the third step is? And write it down. And maybe when you get together with others, share some of your ideas. And then I'm going to give you mine one by one. And I know mine are going to be different from what you think in a lot of cases. Because the principle of the first step is terror. That's what it is. And a lot of people don't want that because they know we've got a step, the fourth step, that tells us how to get rid of fear. But I think the first step is supposed to produce terror. terror of alcohol in my life. I can't get complacent. You know, I'm supposed to be drowning in alcohol. My life's unmanageable. I can't have no power over alcohol at all. Put those together and I am going to get drunk. And that's hell. And I should be scared so that I need an underwear change very, very frequently in my life. That's what the first death is supposed to produce in my life. And as long as I remember that, as long as I think of standing on the water, then hopefully I won't get complacent and the step will be working for me.